I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 10th of November, Monday at 1, all things political. And our guest this hour is David Zwerdlich, associate editor of TheRoot.com. It's a digital magazine that provides thought-provoking commentary and news from a variety of Black perspectives. He recently wrote about 5 takeaways for the president after Tuesday's shellacking and says he has to choose his battles carefully. On Wednesday, David writes, Obama showed signs of life that he probably should have shown during the last several months of the election cycle. He advised him to not tackle immigration. We'll talk about why. Another interesting piece in The Root on Loretta Lynch, 5 things to know about the next attorney general, should she be confirmed. We'll look at the white male vote in the midterm elections and whether or not there's an overlying reason to be a Democrat or to be a Republican. Did either party present a vision for the future that was exciting to voters? So that's just a wee bit of what we'll talk about this hour, and welcome your phone calls as we always do. The phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And we're on Facebook, where if you like us, you can get updates on all our programs, so you may want to do that. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hello, David. Thank you very much for being with us again.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have you here. In a piece that you wrote about 5 things that the president should take away, you write about his showing signs of life on Wednesday that he probably should have shown during the last several months of the election cycle. He did seem to be kind of removed for the past few months. Why do you think he was?
Well, you know, I think that the White House, maybe they wouldn't characterize it this way, Kathleen, but they were really struggling with figuring out how to, at the one hand, press forward with their agenda, try to make some good news come out of what they've been working on the last year or 2 years, even though they've been sort of facing some political headwinds, and then at the same time realizing that in some of these key Senate races that Democrats wound up doing, frankly, very poorly in Kentucky, North Carolina, et cetera, Georgia, some of these other states, they wanted to give these candidates space to not be too closely linked to the president if his poll numbers were not doing well in those particular states. And I think that's baked into the cake now. There's been a lot of discussion about it. I'm certainly not the first person to say that, but I would just add to all of that they not only, Kathleen, did they not quite strike that right balance, but I don't even think there's consensus on why that happened. And I think that coming out of that moment on last Wednesday, on that press conference that the president gave, he kind of took the tone of, look, we lost, it's over, Republicans beat us, but I'm me, and here's what I'm going to do. I mean, we can dig into some more of the specifics of what he talked about, but it was clear that the president wanted to, A, acknowledge that they had not, they meaning he and Democrats, had not done well in this election, but at the same time say, look, this doesn't mean that our agenda is changing. And I think that's where we wound up.
Mm-hmm. Stan Greenberg, you probably read these thoughts, had this to say. To me, he said the biggest mistake the Democrats made was not talking about health care. By failing to talk about the law and its successes, it really, Democrats allowed Republicans, he said, to define the president's signature domestic accomplishment as a failure, and it went virtually unchallenged. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, healthcare wound up sort of as a stalemate. On the one hand, as you just said, Kathleen, right, Republicans were not able to effectively run against the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. It's not popular yet, but it's not unpopular enough anymore that Republicans were able to really make hay out of it in this election. At the same time, Democrats, I think, across the country still feel somewhat burned by the political backlash against Obamacare, and so they weren't able to turn it into a positive for themselves in their campaign, although some would argue, I would be one of those people who would argue, that they should have tried a little harder because they did not, even in some of these key Senate races that cost Democrats the Senate, even try. And it's the same, Kathleen, if I could just piggyback on that,
sure,
with the economic message of the administration and congressional Democrats, right? Last week, the week that people went to the polls, we knew that there was 3.5% positive GDP growth in the third quarter. We knew that the stock market was still breaking records, way above 17,000, 10,000 plus points higher than Obama's first 100 days in office. Unemployment is below 6%. You have some other good, not tremendous economic numbers, but positive economic numbers. And it wasn't until this post-election press conference that I think a lot of people heard the president saying, hey, things aren't as bad as everybody's saying. He did say that on the campaign trail, but it didn't cut through all of the noise that Republicans were sort of throwing at Democrats, and that's why we wound up with the result we wound up with.
I'm wondering about the overriding theme, if there was one, for either the Republican Party or the Democrats, and I don't think anybody had this, which strikes me as it's no surprise that we had the lowest turnout for a midterm election since 1940. I don't know what either party was offering in terms of, here's what we're going to do for you, here's how we're going to make your life better. Did either party capture that desire that we have for a better future?
No, and this ties all into this, not in my opinion anyway, Kathleen. I think the Republican message on a national level, obviously it varied from race to race, but nationally Republicans were running against the status quo. They were running against President Obama, running against Democrats' policy priorities. There was not a lot of Republican messaging on issues like reform of Medicare and Social Security. They didn't run on that. Republicans really didn't run on foreign policy in anything more than a generalized sense. What they ran on was the president isn't doing enough to fight terror, but no Republicans were out there saying, oh, I would send more troops to Iraq, or I would bomb Syria more. They weren't saying that. They were just simply saying, we don't like what the president's doing. And I think in a year when people are sort of frustrated about the general state of things in the world, there are a lot of things in the world that make people anxious about their personal situation, the situation of the country. And in a year when, frankly, Kathleen, Democrats did not, again, do a good job of saying, okay, we've made some incremental progress in these areas, that is what you're going to wind up with. I mean, on the policy, I think we could have a broader discussion, but on the politics, this time around, Democrats, it seems to me, got outplayed. I don't think there's any way to sugarcoat that.
The president has indicated, David, that he is going to do something, executive order on immigration. You said this very straightforwardly in that piece I was mentioning. Don't tackle immigration. Plans to bypass Congress would very likely put impeachment on the table.
Yeah, and so I want to be clear about this. As a columnist, as someone, as a citizen, as someone with opinions, I actually think that Congress should move forward with this. The bill that the Senate passed earlier this year, I think, was a good bill. The House declined to vote on it. I would favor comprehensive immigration reform as a matter of policy. On the politics and on the sort of balance of power issue in Washington, right, as you said, I wrote in my column last Wednesday, I don't think it's a politically smart thing to do for the president to push forward with broad executive action on this issue, even though a lot of the Democratic base, a lot of Latino voters, for instance, want him to do that. For one thing, it will put impeachment back on the table. Republicans have talked a lot about impeachment, Kathleen, in the last couple of years, but they've never been able to hang it on anything or pin it on anything. You know, the case on Benghazi is flimsy. The case on IRS is flimsy. But I think it will renew this talk if there's a major executive action on immigration. Whether or not the leadership of Republicans in Congress want to go down the impeachment road, I think there are enough rank-and-file members in Congress who would like to at least open up the discussion again. I think that's a danger for the Obama White House. I realize that they have other considerations, but that is a danger for them, no question.
The New York Times had some interesting breakdown of votes, and I'd like for you to address white men for a moment, if you
sure
would. North Carolina, more than a third of the voters were white men. Kay Hagan lost their votes by 42 points. Mary Landrieu in Louisiana got support from 15% of white men who voted. But in Michigan, the Democratic Senate candidate Gary Peters prevailed after a long campaign in which he aggressively appealed to white men. How do you explain that?
Well, you know, this is a demographic that Democrats have not done well with in a large number of the last several cycles, right? I mean, Democrats have done better with white women and done particularly better with unmarried white women. Democrats have also done far, far better than Republicans in the last several election cycles with voters of color, African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans, et cetera, and better with Jewish American voters as well. White men, particularly married white men or older white men, this is now becoming this calcified voting bloc that Democrats don't seem to be able to communicate with, to message to you know, find common ground with. And, you know, I've heard other Democratic strategists, you know, take Democrats to task and say, look, you know, there's all this talk about creating a coalition of single women and younger voters and voters of color, but Democrats, maybe these next 2 years, really do need to pay a little more attention to how they're not communicating effectively with white men. Now, that, of course, goes both ways. Clearly, there's something about the Democratic policy priorities that white men are not responding to, and sometimes I do wonder how much of that is about messaging and how much of that is about issues. You know, it goes back to this thing where, you know, we talk about certain things like issues like Obamacare, and it doesn't poll well against white men, and yet at the same time, there are obviously plenty of white men who avail themselves of Obamacare that would not want to see some of the specific provisions of it repealed. So I think a lot of it has to do with political positioning and the fact that our politics, in terms of the demographics, Kathleen, are becoming just more polarized.
Mm-hmm.
There's no getting around it. I'm looking at the overall national exit polls here in the New York Times, and you see that among white Americans, Democrats are just struggling to get a hold of a large part of that demographic. That doesn't mean no white people vote for Democrats, right? I mean, President Obama would not have won election and re-election without white votes. But clearly the edge that Democrats and President Obama hold is with the voter of color, younger voter, women voter coalition.
Right.
So,
David, when you look at how the economy isn't as bad as some Republicans might believe, what is it that's causing anxiety? Is it that our paychecks aren't what they used to be, that for a long time now we're just not making as much money as we used to, and we're working harder, and everybody's working, and some people are working two jobs? Do we want some path out of that? What are we looking for?
I think that's the question that everyone's asking themselves from the White House on down. Let me take a stab at it, Kathy.
Sure.
One more point on the demographics. So, you know, if the magic number for Democrats, let's say, is not to fall below 40% of the white vote, and the magic number for Republicans is to somehow get more than 20% of voters of color, I think that is one of the fault lines in our politics. And I'm sure some of your listeners are out there thinking, you know, why does our politics have to be so polarized along these hard and fast demographic lines? And part of it is just that we, as a society, we've come a long way, but we still are segmented into groups at various times, including in voting. But I think part of it is that different groups see different issues a different way, partly because of their experience, partly because of the dynamic within that group. So, for instance, something like Obamacare, and now I'm going back to your question about the big picture, with Obamacare, as unpopular as it's been, even now, 75% of African Americans are pro-Obamacare. And so, you know, when people think, oh, well, African Americans just vote democratically because they always vote for Democrats. Well, no, they also agree with what Democrats are doing, something like the Affordable Care Act. To your question more broadly, Kathleen, you know, what are people anxious about? I think it's a mistake, I'll say it that way, to pin it on one thing. I think we are all still sort of skittish about the economy coming out of 2008. It seems like, in some ways, like a long time ago, and in other ways, it wasn't that long ago. And even though we see the stock market roaring along, 401ks have come back to life, even though there's been job growth and GDP growth for successive quarters, there's this sense, I think, and this is, I don't have a statistic for you, this is just a feeling that, you know, there's not this robust, optimistic view of the future, and that does cause voters to sort of recoil when they get into the ballot box,
mm-hmm.
and they're kind of looking at their choices, and they're like, well, I don't agree with everything that, you know, just to go back to 2012, that Mitt Romney has to say, and I don't have to agree with everything that Barack Obama has to say. So now you're in this position where you're voting for the person who you think least goes against what you want to see happen. I think for a lot of people, that's one thing. And then the other thing is that, you know, the world, it sounds like a cliche, but the world is really more complicated than it may have been a generation or two ago in terms of the economy. A lot of these white male voters that we are talking about, particularly, say, in the Midwest, had good-paying hourly wage, secure, sometimes even union, manufacturing, blue-collar jobs, and those are jobs that are almost beyond the power of any president
yes.
to bring back robustly in the same way that a president might be able to, you know, take initiatives to foster growth in service sector jobs or technology jobs, which are good jobs, but might be more available to millennials and not, say, to a middle-aged white married man in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
That's the challenge.
I think you're right on the right path with that analysis. David Zwerdlich is our guest. We will talk more about the Supreme Court's decision to take up the Affordable Care Act once again. What was behind the decision to do that, and is there a real danger that it could be the undoing of the Affordable Care Act? Also, we'll look at the president's pick for attorney general and whether or not the confirmation will be easy. She has an interesting background, Loretta Lynch. We'll talk about her and more this hour. We're still doing an analysis, as we will for a little bit, of what the midterms were telling us about what we're concerned about now and why we voted the way we did. I just find it incredible, and I don't care if you're terribly enthusiastic or not about a candidate, to have the midterm election, the lowest turnout since 1940, is just shameful. Well, we welcome your phone calls. Here's our phone number. What were the five takeaways for the president, as David framed it, for what were the five takeaways for the Republican Party, for the Democratic Party? What do they learn in terms of how will they secure the presidency in 2016? What was it that motivated you when you voted? And I know everybody who listens to us votes, but was it the economy? Was it you feel jittery about the future? Was it foreign policy? What was it? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, where you can also like us and get updates on shows. And our Twitter is @KDunnShow. David Zwerdlich is a guest of ours fairly often. He's associate editor of TheRoot.com, a digital magazine that has really good perspectives on a variety of news issues. So we'll continue, and I hope you'll join us in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Zwerdlich, our guest this hour, associate editor of TheRoot.com. It's all things political, which means exactly what I just said, all things political, and, of course, a focus on last week's midterm elections. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. John in Madison, our first caller. Hi, John.
Good afternoon. The reason I voted was, basically because it's my duty to vote and get myself informed so I could do a good job at that, I felt. But specifically this time around, it was the governor's situation that I was concerned about. I'm grateful that, and it was before I voted, that big money is buying its way into Wisconsin politics, and the result is not going to be good for the average person, and specifically those people who are underprivileged in terms of the money that they may have at their disposal, and through no fault of their home, perhaps they don't have a job or they're in some way handicapped. And that's all I have to say, Kathleen.
All right, John, thanks very much. And big money, he's right. And can you imagine what it will be for the presidential election, David? Holy Toledo.
Yeah, Holy Toledo is right, Kathleen. Oh. You know, in the wake of Citizens United, in the wake of some of the other Supreme Court rulings, clearly the floodgates have been open. You know, there's a debate on one level to decide whether or not this is, you know, it would be constitutional to have more campaign finance restrictions in place. The prevailing trend is that this is a pure free speech matter, and that different groups and different interests can pour as much money as they want to into these elections. On the level of whether or not it's good for our society, You know, I'm not so sure about that. I mean, the elections are now dominated, as your caller said, by those who have the most money, not necessarily by those pushing particular issues, or not necessarily by those candidates who connect the best with voters in all those cases. In the North Carolina Senate race between Tom Tillis and Kay Hagan, the Democratic incumbent who lost, you know, my assessment of it would be that Kay Hagan ran a fairly good race. She was one of the few candidates who actually did strike a balance between not abandoning President Obama as a person and the Obama agenda, at the same time saying, look, I'm my own person, I don't agree with the president on every single issue, and she didn't make a lot of mistakes, and she was well-funded, and people in North Carolina, generally speaking, I know this because I'm a North Carolinian, you know, think she's, you know, been a responsible senator. But Tillis ran a very aggressive campaign. Tillis had a lot of money, and Tillis pounded her relentlessly with his message that she was tied too close to Obama, and she lost narrowly in that state. I think money had a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no question that it's a factor.
Right. Thanks, John, for the call. Jerry in Fort Atkinson. Hi.
Hi. I'd like to have your opinion on why white men voted the way they did. I hear a lot of discussion about it was white men who voted primarily Republican, but never why. I'm a white man, and I voted Republican. And I think probably when I look at the Democratic agenda, there isn't anything there for white men, so why should I vote?
So, and do you think there is something on the Republican agenda, something for white men?
I think one of the things that appeals is the fact that a high percentage of white men are educated, and they recognize that limited government and that business, small business and large business, are some of the strong points of our economy. So looking at that may have some effect, but I don't know if there's something more. But they're not addressing any issues that white men have, so not even the Republicans. So,
David,
can I jump in on that?
Yeah, sure.
So, and I forgot, I'm sorry, the caller's name again.
Jerry.
So, no, I understand exactly what Jerry's saying, and I would probably not, you know, quibble with the point about, you know, white men, you know, writ large, not seeing that the Democratic Party always has their interest in mind, especially if we're talking about what we were talking about before the break with, you know, there's a particular subset of white men, you're married, middle-aged or older, blue-collar white men who have seen their economic prospects dim a little bit in recent years. So I certainly understand that. The one thing I would maybe push back on about the limited government piece, and I don't want to sound too partisan here, is that, you know, what Republicans have advertised, I think, in recent years and what they've actually delivered has to a certain extent been two different things. So, for instance, I'll pick on Congressman Paul Ryan, since he's a prominent Wisconsin politician, and say, look, you know, I think he's a responsible legislator with some interesting ideas, but he does sort of talk about limited government and about getting government out of people's lives. But over the course of his congressional career, he voted for TARP, the biggest ever bank bailout. He voted for No Child Left Behind, a big government federal solution to, you know, state and local school district issues. He voted for the Iraq War, that's as big as government as you can get. He voted for multiple auto bailouts. So it's one thing to say I'm for limited government, but it's another thing when you get right down to it and say, okay, what are you limiting? Are you limiting, are you cutting off, SNAP benefits, you know, food stamps for people? Okay, that would be limited government. But if you're doing that, are you cutting off subsidies for dairy farmers as well? I don't think that would be popular in the Midwest. But that's the kind of thing that, you know, when you talk about limited government, are we talking about limited government across the board or just limited government in certain instances? And I think Republicans have done a good job, Kathleen, back to the political analysis, of messaging their limited government message, and that's to their credit. That's what they're supposed to be doing as a political party. Whether they've actually delivered on limited government in recent years, I'm a little more skeptical of that.
Thank you, Jerry, very much for the call. And I know it's a big task to have to speak for all white men in the country, but thank you. I think your analysis gave us some insight. I want to, we'll go back to phones in a moment. I want to talk about the Supreme Court saying that it would hear this case on the Affordable Care Act, which, you know, if they rule against it, it could just, it seems to me, demolish the program. Why do you think, David, they decided to hear this case?
Well, it's a part of an ongoing series of these challenges to the Affordable Care Act. We're getting now to the point where I think we're challenging on some technicalities, which the plaintiffs have every right to do. I just, again, would sort of take a step back and say, okay, what is the real motivation behind this? When you had the big 2012 Supreme Court decision on the Affordable Care Act, that was when the court was really deciding on the broad strokes of this policy. You know, is the penalty for not signing up for health care a tax or is it not? And is it constitutional to essentially mandate to force someone to buy a product, which the Affordable Care Act in a fashion does? Those were some big framing constitutional issues. If you look at the case now, Kathleen, I'm guessing you and your listeners have talked about this on previous shows, we're really in the weeds of it now. My understanding of it from a layman's point of view is that that we're basically talking about a situation where the wording in the law suggests that, okay, only states that adopted the Affordable Care Act and the Medicaid expansion and their own exchanges are able to give tax credits, and that the law doesn't specifically say that in states where there is no Affordable Care Act implementation, that the federal government can step in and give those tax credits to people who buy insurance. If that view prevails at the Supreme Court level, that would mean that essentially in every state where the states have rejected the Affordable Care Act, there would be no mechanism to give people who sign up who need the tax credits the tax credits. Where I think it's a technicality is this. It strikes me as, even though it was poor drafting in the law, it's almost inconceivable to me that Congress intended that only in states where there are state exchanges could this law work, and in states where the states rejected the Affordable Care Act, that the federal government could not step in and have essentially its own exchange. So in Kentucky, where you have Connect, and it's working fairly well, you can just keep right on going. And in a state like Texas, where there is no Affordable Care Act implementation and there are, you know, hundreds of thousands of people without insurance coverage, now the federal government can't offer any health incentives to people who, tax incentives to sign up on healthcare.gov. It strikes me as that wasn't the intent of Congress, for better or worse. And so I don't know where the Supreme Court is going to come down on this, but it's one of those things where, and I'll wrap in a second here, but it's one of those things where, on the one hand, the court is slightly tilting to the right, so they may be inclined to restrain the law to the letter of the law. On the other hand, a conservative court, in my view, would not set itself in the shoes of Congress when it sort of knows what Congress's intent was in passing the law.
Yeah, interesting. Molly is our next caller. Hi, Molly.
Hi. Going back to what was said about the Republicans say one thing and then what they deliver, I worked the phone banks for Mary Burke, and what we heard a lot of was that people, and when who we were calling were Democratic voters, you know, just to get the vote out, mm-hmm. remind them to get out and vote. And what we heard a lot of was they were voting their religion, so they were voting for the Republican because they were voting their religion. So I think this is going back to the abortion issue.
David, what do you think?
Well, I'm of two minds about that. Abortion and same-sex marriage are probably the two issues where I'm least inclined to say that there's two ways to look at it. With abortion, right, and this is to your caller's point, if someone believes that life begins at conception, then that's what they believe. And it's really hard to go any further with that discussion. And if someone believes that life doesn't begin at conception, it's really hard to sort of, go any further with that angle in the discussion. So, if people, in fact, were voting for Walker, versus Burke in an election where, in my mind, as an outsider to Wisconsin politics, the issues on the table were more economic, then I guess that's the way they were voting, and you can't really question people for voting their conscience. On the flip side, if you look at an issue like same-sex marriage, and I know that she didn't specifically bring that up, that's one of those things where, you know, it's really comes down to me to be a cut-and-dried 10th Amendment versus 14th Amendment issue, and in my mind, the 14th Amendment trumps. People say, oh, well, you know, states should be able to do what they want, but if you believe that the 14th Amendment guarantees everyone equal protection under the law, and courts have backed this up now in many states, it's very hard to come up with a non-religious argument against same-sex marriage. You know, I realize reasonable people may disagree on that, but so we're in this sort of intractable point back to the politics where on these two issues, people are sort of voting their conscience. I wonder, though, you know, where we're headed with this, because on the issue of abortion, I think we're sort of locked in place. On the issue of same-sex marriage, the discussion is clearly going in one way.
Yeah,
same-sex marriage
absolutely.
Is going to be a reality in 50 states. It's just a matter of when, not if.
Yeah, thanks, Molly, very much for your call. And somebody did an analysis looking at those issues. Colorado and Iowa were states where Democrats lost Senate seats after campaigns that heavily emphasized abortion rights, birth control coverage, and pay equity for women, but they didn't get the kind of support from female voters they thought they would get.
I'm sorry, Kathleen. Yeah, it's one of the issues, abortion, where, again, you know, because people feel so passionately about it, that you can campaign effectively on that as a conservative if you know there is a demographic out there that says, look, this is a voting issue for me. In other words, yes, I may agree with the Democrat on the minimum wage, or I may agree with the Democrat on even the Affordable Care Act, but I am, you know, I feel passionately about the issue of pro-choice versus anti-choice, and I'm not going to vote for someone who's pro-choice. And then, you know, there's nothing that a Democrat who's pro-choice could do to sort of win that vote. So, no, there's no question that it's still an effective issue in play in a lot of places.
Yeah. Larry in Stevens Point. Hi.
Hi. I guess I wanted to respond, and I don't remember his name, the caller who was a white male. I happen to be a white male, 73 years old, with a PhD. He made a point about education. And there's no way in God's green earth I'd vote for the Republican platform. I don't understand what his comment had to do with anything. They just plain are not giving a message which sells for me. I think that a lot of those white men that are voting a way different than I vote just are not listening to the right radio. And I guess I'll just leave it there.
Let me ask you, Larry, did you feel that the Democrats this go around were giving you a message that was worth voting for?
I don't know that they really were giving me a message that was worth voting for. I probably was voting more against the Republican stand on everything that's happened in the state of Wisconsin over the last 6 years.
All right. Thank you very much, Larry, for the call. And what about this idea, David? I heard this discussed on a show this morning on Point, actually, that you can't conduct an election and think that you're going to win if you're voting against something. You have to present issues that will rally voters around your cause. It can't be an anti-vote or you don't win. Is that true, or can you win on an I don't like this person?
I'm not sure if you can make that, you know, assessment across the board. I think it depends on the race and the state and the circumstances. So because Democrats are the in party right now, meaning the Democrats still control the White House, you know, Democrats have to make an affirmative case that what they are doing is the right thing, right? And so it's easier for Republicans to run on this idea of we are against what is going on right now. And then for Democrats, if now that Republicans control both houses of Congress, Democrats will be able to argue essentially that, look, the Congress is controlled by Republicans. So if you don't like what's coming out of Congress, then you shouldn't vote for Republicans in 2016, and that's going to be the give and take. It depends a lot on the size of the election. So, in other words, in a congressional race, the candidate can localize it more. And when you get up to the state or the national level, then you know you've got the national picture coming more and more into view. But at the same time, people, again, this goes back to the caller, John, a few minutes ago. People, what they are voting for and what they actually get is frequently not the same thing. And that cuts both ways. I was saying that Republicans don't always deliver on this small government idea. Democrats also have not effectively said, look, we, over the last 5 years in every case, look, we are the party of government. We are the party that's going to make government a positive force in your life. That has happened in some instances in the last few years, Kathleen, and some instances mm-hmm. it clearly hasn't. The Veterans Administration comes to mind. I think the administration is due for some criticism on that. That's not a new problem that cropped up after the recession. The Veterans Administration in a lot of states has been run very poorly for years and years. That was there to be worked on, to be fixed, and although they're working on it now, it took them too long. And I think that was part and parcel of why people have lost some faith in the administration to get things done this last year or two.
Ralph, Little Suamico, hi.
Yes, hi. I just had two quick points, and then I'll let your guest comment on them. First of all, you hear a lot right now after the election, and this cuts both ways. If the Republicans lose, they'll say the same thing, and that is that if the people that I wanted to vote would have voted, then I would have won. And it boils down to, if you don't vote, you don't count, and it's just as plain as that. So, you know, to say that, well, if more people would have voted in Milwaukee, then Walker would have been out. They didn't, so it doesn't matter. And the other point I was going to make is on contributions. Most of those contributions come from that evil 1% of the people that squirrel all their money away in offshore banks. So if they're willing to take a few billion dollars of that money and send it to local TV stations so that it can help their bottom line and help employ people that work at those TV stations or newspapers or radio or whatever it is, that's money into the economy. So it isn't all negative.
Thanks very much for your call, Ralph. Let's go to the turnout for a moment. If you didn't vote, don't complain. I see his point on that. But why was the turnout so low? David?
There's a lot of things. Again, you know, one is that it was a midterm election, and that because there's no presidential candidate at the top of the ticket for either party, you don't have as much national interest generated in the election. I think that's pretty well established. In this particular 2014 cycle, Democrats, because they perceived their party, I think, not to be succeeding on a variety of fronts, a lot of issues conspired in the last couple of months of the election that did demoralize Democrats. You have the president going back into Iraq, which a lot of Democrats weren't happy about. You had the Ebola crisis. You had the fact that even though we talked about this at the beginning of the show, even though there's some gradual positive economic indicators, Democrats did a poor job of messaging that and getting that out there and into people's consciousness. And then the other thing was that Republicans did catch up a little in terms of getting out their vote. In 2012, the Romney campaign failed to get out their base vote in the way they thought they were going to. In 2014, Republicans ran smarter,
yes,
both
did.
In terms of their message,
right.
And they made a concerted effort to get Republican voters to the polls. And to your caller's point, though, I think it is a wake-up call for Democrats. Look, if let's say in a race in Wisconsin for governor, if people in Democratic-leaning counties in Milwaukee don't come out to vote, well, then they may get a result that goes against what they might have hoped for in terms of the outcome, in terms of Walker being reelected as opposed to Burke,
yeah.
If you're a Democrat. That is a reality that the politicians have to sort of wake up to, but also the voters as well.
Well, and the Democrats would have needed even more than a heavy Democratic turnout in Milwaukee. It was they would have needed more. In terms of the money, I wish I'd call a radio station, or not radio. Most of the money went into TV.
Yeah.
I don't know how much of that trickles down to the local economy, and I wonder what they do with all this money. The television stations around the country must have taken in a bundle on this election. Do you know where the money goes?
Well, I mean, I think the money goes to the bottom line of the outlets that are whether it's TV, radio, whether it's websites that run political ads. I mean, this is ad space that even though they may not be getting top dollar for it the way they might get from a commercial product or a commercial sponsor, this is ad revenue and ad space that they want to sell. Especially if you look at something like the online space. I mean, I know you were talking about TV, Kathleen, but online, websites are happy to sell, especially ideological websites, are happy to sell ad space to campaigns if campaigns want to buy that ad space on their web pages. You know, there are lots of rules governing the availability of that ad space to both sides of the argument, but govern the proper transfer of that money for those political ads and what the content of those ads can be. But there's no question that people are motivated to put those ads on the air. That's built into the model of any media outlet, I think, at this point.
David Zwerdlik is our guest, and you're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David is associate editor of TheRoot.com, which is an excellent website to go to because it does analysis of politics and cultural issues. We have yet to talk about the nomination of Loretta Lynch as the next attorney general. She has a really impressive background. We'll briefly talk to David about that and take many more of your phone calls. If you're on hold, bear with us for just a moment, and we'll be with you. Our number, if you would like to join us, is 800-486-8655. And our email, talk@WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, MIT is one of the first colleges in the country to try to put a precise estimate on the prevalence of sexual violence on its campus. The numbers look very troubling. We'll talk about consent, respect, and sexual assault with Mike Domish, who is the founder of Date Safe Project. That's tomorrow during this time period. David Zwerdlik is with us now. Back to phone calls. I didn't want to let the hour go by, though, without your thoughts on Loretta Lynch, whether or not she really has an impressive background. I would assume she would have a fairly easy confirmation, do you think, or not?
You know, that remains to be seen. On the one hand, Republicans have to be thinking to themselves, look, if coming out of this election and knowing that the next election cycle is a national election, not a midterm, where you're going to have a larger electorate, where you're going to have potentially Hillary Clinton on the ballot for the Democrats, where they're going to need to make inroads with voters of color, the idea of challenging a black woman nominee too ferociously could backfire on them.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, Republicans have been very, very sort of caustic in their approach to Attorney General Eric Holder, and I do think that they are going to try to extract some concessions from the White House in terms of, look, this is what we want to see coming out of the Department of Justice in the next 2 years, and even though traditionally the Senate has left these kind of nominations to the discretion of the president, they mostly rubber-stamped them. I think we're out of that era, Kathleen.
Mm.
I think she will be confirmed, but she is going to be scrutinized fairly heavily, even though she does, as you pointed out, have a really interesting background. She's prosecuted terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
She's prosecuted some high-profile civil rights cases. She has deep roots in civil rights. She's known as a very tough prosecutor, but at the same time, a person who's very in tune with a lot of the nuances of the issues that she'll face. But, we're past the era in our politics, kind of what we've been discussing this whole time, where a Republican Congress is going to just sort of rubber stamp an Obama nominee.
Well, is it going to happen in the lame duck session?
I, you know, That I don't know right now. That's, I think, what the White House is pushing for. One of the reasons why they wanted to get that nomination out right after the election, to not waste any time, both to get her in place, but also to send a message that they weren't going to be cowed by the election results, to say, look, hey, we lost in November, but the Obama administration is pressing forward with the people we want and the agenda we want, and we're going to have to find a way to work with Congress. I think that was the message that they wanted to send by putting out a nominee last Friday. You know, I bet you Republicans would like to step back and take a look at this, and we're up against the holidays, and there are budget issues to work with, and, you know, let's not forget, they've still not even voted on whether or not we should be waging war in Syria. So,
okay.
I don't know what the legislative calendar is going to look like. I'm still trying to figure that out myself.
Sammy in Valley Junction, hi.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I think the Democrats made a huge mistake by running away from their votes, especially for senators in the last 6 years. And I don't vote for somebody to just go to Washington and get reelected. I vote for them to make the tough votes, make the tough decisions. And if that sacrifices their political career on the altar of good things happening, I just think there's too much concern about the next election, and they should have stood on their votes and ran toward it instead of away from it. I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks, Sammy. I think he's right. I think there's a whole lot of that, David.
Yeah, no, Kathleen. I mean, I wish I had the number in front of me. I'll try and Google it up while we're still on the air. The number of Democratic senators who voted in favor of the Affordable Care Act in 2010 who have now lost their Senate seats is there's a high number. I think it might be the majority of the Democrat, not the majority, but I better not quote the number because I don't have it at my fingertips. But a lot of Democrats who voted for the Affordable Care Act are no longer in Congress, and it's in a way you could say, to the point that the caller was making. Look, you wanted to get something done. You wanted to get the Affordable Care Act done, and that may be the price of getting something done. And it's okay, people in Congress should be willing to sacrifice their political career on a principle, and I think no one would disagree with that comment. But when you have people who've worked their whole lives to get to Congress, who have constituencies and neighborhoods and in some cases, corporate interests invested in them, it is hard for them to let go on such a controversial issue and knowing that they might lose that vote. In some cases, though, right, what would be the point of completely distancing yourself from Democratic Party priorities? Why would you be a Democrat then? The example
right.
that comes to mind is Alison Lundergan Grimes
right.
Kentucky. Right. I mean, look, let's not second guess and Monday morning quarterback the whole race, just the one issue. If you're a Democrat, the idea that you won't tell people you voted for President Obama strikes voters on either side of the aisle as You don't have a spine, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, the thing is, you're not going to get Republicans to vote for you if you deny that you voted for Obama.
You're right.
And those persuadable voters are in the middle are going to say, well, I would have at least considered you if you had just said, look, I voted for Obama even though I don't agree with him on everything. She didn't, and I think that probably didn't change the outcome of the election, but it certainly contributed to the real drubbing that she faced last week.
Yeah. Thanks, Sammy, for the call. Kit in Mount Horeb. Hi.
Hi, I'm one to respond to the gentleman who called earlier who said he was an old white man and didn't see what the Democrats had to offer. I would like to have, it stuns me the lack of history in these people. The Democrats gave us Social Security, they gave us Medicare, and two of the most valuable institutions. If this person doesn't have any idea of what the poverty was in this country among the elderly back in 1932, you ought to learn something. It isn't a question about some minor issue like gay marriage or abortion rights right now. It's about a huge shift that's gone on for the last 35 years in taking away income from the poor and giving it to the rich, and we're having a very ugly, polarized society. And if the Republicans have their way, they will be very happy to get rid of Social Security or at least make the Wall Street the brokers of it, which would be an enormous windfall for the rich again, and on and on.
Thank you, Kit. Now, maybe that's the message the Democrats needed to give. What do you think, David?
Yeah, no, possibly. No, I was going to say, I don't have too much to add to that. I think the caller made several, you know, very valid points.
Yeah. This is from the Washington Examiner. KP found 15 senators who voted for the Affordable Care Act either failed to win re-election or declined to run for re-election and had their seats turned over to Republicans.
So. Yeah, no, and we've seen that in these, especially in 2010 and 2014. Democrats fared a little bit better in 2012 when President Obama was on the ballot for re-election, and they'll probably fare better in 2016 because most of the seats that are facing re-election in the Senate in 2016 are seats that are currently controlled by Republicans. So the roles are going to reverse in terms of who's on offense and who's on defense in this next election. But in 2014, whatever else we take away, and this has been well-traveled territory in the last week, Democrats really had their hats handed to them last week.
They sure did. One more call. Just 20 seconds, Norm, but you can do it. Hi, Norm.
Hi. One of the more intelligent comments I've heard about the last election was that Americans have to disavow themselves of the notion that presidential elections matter so much, and it's really Congress is where it's at. How do we get people to realize that?
Well, quickly, I think it's both. I've heard that before, too. It makes a lot of sense to me, and I would say that it's really both. You know, we don't have a parliamentary system, so in the president we invest both obviously your callers, Kathleen, know this, but just to make the point, we invest both the head of government and the head of state. So there is a lot still in the president. The president reflects the national mood, the national ideals. But when you're talking about allocating money, when you're talking about some of these issues that really affect people from week to week, your caller is absolutely right. It's Congress. It's your state legislatures. It's your city councils. It's your governors. It's all of these things.
Thanks, David. Always a pleasure to have you on. Thanks.
Thank you, Kathleen.
David Zwerdlik, associate editor of TheRoot.com. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this segment of All Things Political and for doing on-air production as well here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. News coming up. We'll return.